with the irrigation district bills first. This should go fairly quickly. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 691.
Okay. Anybody testify?
Rashida, you want to? Are you testifying on it?
Okay.
You got the camera?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which is a statewide voluntary trade association of irrigation districts, water control districts, and other associations and private entities that deliver and manage water. If you don't mind indulging me, I know there's a public hearing open for Senate Bill 691, but I put my testimony for the three bills on one piece of paper, and I can just kind of step through them that way. These are three bills that are kind of related, and they're housekeeping but important to our district.
Okay. I'd be happy to open a hearing on all of them. So you can
sure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It was open a public hearing on Senate Bill 691, 692, and
693.
693.
691A. 691A, 692,
and 693.
Perfect. Thank you. Senate Bill 691 relates
hang
to...
Hang on, Christina. Sorry. Why don't we do a little summary here with Cletus, and then we'll...
I'll hold my horse.
From there. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair and Committee, SB 691-A allows the Board of Directors of Irrigation District during organizational meeting to establish date of next annual organizational meeting, allows the Board of Directors to designate manager of Irrigation District as Secretary of Board. SB 692 changes date of elections in irrigation districts when regular election date falls on legal holiday, changes date on which newly elected director in irrigation district takes oath of office, allows the Board of Directors of Irrigation District during organizational meeting to establish date of next annual organizational meeting. SB 693 changes persons authorized to sign checks or drafts for irrigation district. That also includes on the amendment to allow any two individuals authorized by the board to sign checks, drafts, and make electronic transfers.
Thank you. Members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Christina McNitt. That pretty much steals my thunder, but I'll still walk through the bills. Senate Bill 691, it does allow that a district board of directors may appoint its district manager as a secretary, and further, it allows the district to fix by resolution the date of its annual organizational meeting other than the currently prescribed date of the first Tuesday in January. The purpose of this is to expand the number of persons eligible to be appointed to serve as a district secretary, and the second purpose of this bill is to provide administrative flexibility to the board in setting its annual organizational meeting in order to avoid having two meetings in January. Some districts have their regular meeting already, say, the second Thursday in January, and then statute requires then that they would have two meetings in January. Senate Bill 692, also relating to elections of irrigation district directors. The language in Section 1 mirrors the language in Senate Bill 691 about allowing the district board to fix by resolution the date of its annual organizational meeting. And the second portion of Senate Bill 692 in Section 1, Sub 3, states that a newly elected director takes his or her official oath at the annual organizational meeting in January, as opposed to existing state statute in ORS 545-153, which states that the certificate of election is to be given immediately following the election, followed by the oath of office within 10 days. And what that sets up is a situation where the board could have two directors signed and sworn into office, the outgoing members and the incoming members, although the incoming new directors really don't take office until the annual organizational meeting in January. And the third thing that Senate Bill 692 does, in Section 1, Sub 4, it provides the ability for districts to set their annual November election date on the day after the first Tuesday, if the first Tuesday is a holiday. And the purpose of this change is that no provisions exist in irrigation district election statutes for when an election conflicts with a holiday. We conduct most of our elections by mail, and Veterans Day has been a direct conflict for our districts in the past. So this would help resolve that conflict. And finally, Senate Bill 693, relating to authorized signatures. This bill, with the dash one amendments, deletes current law that restricts district check signers to only the president and the secretary of the board. Rather, it allows the board of directors to designate at least two authorized parties to sign checks. And the dash one amendments also allow electronic funds transfers authorized by the board and initiated by at least two individuals authorized by the board. I hope that provides some clarity on these small bills, and I really appreciate the Rules Committee taking the time to hear. This is our fourth bill in front of the committee, and I appreciate it.
Christina, I just had a couple very simple questions, I think, on Senate Bill 692, lines 18 through 20. Notwithstanding a subsection of this section, if the second Tuesday in November falls on a holiday as defined, ORS 187, blah, blah, blah. The election shall be held the day following the second Tuesday in November. What? Thanksgiving is the
fourth Thursday.
What holiday is there that am I missing one?
Yes,
Veterans Day.
11th day of the 11th month of the
Armistice Day.
Yeah, at 11 o'clock.
Not
yes, so that's your concern is basically that if it falls on Veterans Day that.
Mr. Chair and members, that's been our conflict in the past.
Okay. Any questions, colleagues, on Senate Bill 6?
Mr. Chairman, just curious if Senator Shields had an irrigation district in his district.
Well, you know, Representative Dalton, that's a question for Christina.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Kind of a rhetorical question.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't believe that he does, but he's interested in district governance.
Thank you.
Christina, on Senate Bill 693, can you just tell me the reason for the change on lines 12 through 17, or excuse me, lines 12 through 16, where you just change it from the president and secretary of the board to two individuals authorized by the board? What's the problem that?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Most irrigation districts, they have either three board members or they have five. In any case, they don't have very many, like, office personnel. And so we have had some district boards report to us that if they don't have some flexibility in naming who those check signers can be, if someone's on vacation or they're out of town, it really restricts the ability of the board to complete business. And also, I would just like to point out that that would actually be in lines 13 and 14 of the dash one. Amendments rather than the original bill. The dash one amendments replace the original bill.
We are we're not moving the dash ones, right? Or we are moving the dash ones?
I would hope so, but you're not in work session yet.
You know, you have to be in work session if you're going to move anything. You know that, right?
Right.
So I'd have to close the public hearing first, then go into work session.
Right.
That's what I'd have to do. You guys clear on that?
You finally got that, huh?
I just want you to know it better late than never that I fully understand the mechanics of the committee. Okay, wonderful. Well, we will close the public hearing, which I'm going to do right now with the gavel.
Thank you.
Do I have to hit it three times?
No, sir.
I can hit it three times.
No, just once is enough.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on all three bills for clarification. And open a work session on 691.
Mr. Chair, I would move we pass Senate Bill 691A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March moves we pass Senate Bill 691A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Vanetta?
Aye.
691. Assuming necessary affirmative votes will be moved to the floor. Representative Holby.
Can I move that to the consent calendar?
Yes, you may. Representative Greenlick moves 691 to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, can I just order that, or do I have to vote on that?
No, you can just order it without objection.
I'm ordering it.
Done, sir.
Without objection, so ordered.
Without objection, done, sir.
There's no objection, Annetta, so I'm going to order it, okay? I just like to be able to say it. I'm going to order it like that. Well, now, so we're in 691 still, right? I'm there. Close it on 691. Open it on 692. Representative March.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 692 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March moves Senate Bill 692 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none. Netta.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Bill 693 receiving the necessary votes.
Move that to the consent calendar.
Representative Greenlick moves 693. Did I do? Sorry. I'm with you. To the consent calendar. Any objection? None. Ordered. Open a work session on Senate Bill 693. What's that?
Close 692.
Well, we close the 692 with that, and now I'm also going to open a work session on Senate Bill 693 now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
I move Senate Bill 693 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
There's an amendment.
I move the dash one amendment. Is it dash one?
Yep.
I'm not seeing it.
Representative Thatcher moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 693. Any objection? Any discussion? So ordered. Representative March.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 693 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March moves Senate Bill 693 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Netta.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye.
Senate Bill 693 to the consent calendar.
Representative Greenlick moves Senate Bill 693 to the consent calendar. Any objection? None. Ordered. Done.
Here's the train coming.
Closing the hearing on 693.
Sure.
Work session. Jeez, Derek. All right. Colleagues, we'll be opening a public hearing on House Bill 3238. Cletus, if you want to read the summary, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HB 3238 has come before the committee on 419. It permits standing committees of Legislative Assembly to review temporary pending and final agency rules. Permits Legislative Assembly to adopt concurrent resolution approving rule or rejection or amending rule. Makes pending rules effective at conclusion of session of Legislative Assembly during which rule is submitted for review. Prevents agency's intended action from remaining in effect beyond date of Legislative Assembly. Amends or rejects rules. Requires agency to implement legislative intent as expressed in concurrent resolution. Makes all administrative rules expire every 2 years unless extended by statute. This bill has been amended. The amendments represent a merger of the concepts as HB 203, HB 2188, and HB 3238. HB 2188 represents the recommendations of a 10-member year-long work group established by the bill in 2003 session of the legislature. The amendments raise the bar of the requested committee review of an administrative rule. It broadens the review of proposed rules to proposed and existing rules. The bill preserves the requirements that the Legislative Council Committee and committees of original jurisdiction receive notice of proposed rulemaking. The dash 12 amendment clarifies the minimum intent that falls within the current statutory provisions that agencies may rely on existing information. The amendment addresses the waiver rule option. Further, the amendment clarifies the provisions that apply to adoptions only and to narrow the scope of review. Committee, you have before you the dash 12s and dash 13s. The dash 12, there's been a change in going to 13 that's deals on page 4 of your dash 12s, lines 10, 11, and 12. Modify it on page 4 of your dash 13, lines 10 through 22. The first sentence in subsection 3 has been eliminated and rewritten and organized, dealt with some judicial conflicts of which all the parties agree are okay.
Could you say 10, 11, and 12
on your dash 12? Page 4, lines 10, 11, and 12. That has been deleted and replaced with, on page 4 of your dash 13, with the statement that's there in sub 3, sub A, B, and C,
And it basically reorganized that paragraph and took out the contested conflicts that were within, came out of the AG's office.
I'm sorry, Chris.
Put it in agreement, problem. On page 4.
Are you saying all of line 10, 11, and 12, including that for the purposes of?
Deleted.
Let's go ahead and get under discussion, and Representative Greenlee, I'm sure any clarification can be made by those that are making the amendments.
Thank you.
That's all right.
Hi, Susan Graby for the State Bar, Chair Kitts, members of the committee. I'm here just to explain briefly the Dash 13s. I think your committee administrator had it right. All the Dash 13s do is on the Dash 12s, I believe it's page 4 of the Dash 12s, it deletes lines 10 through 12, which is just the first sentence, which was confusing the two different tests.
Okay. And then the purposes of on line 12 is also deleted?
It's slightly reworded. On the Dash 12s?
Yeah.
For purposes of judicial review is slightly reworded in the Dash 13s.
It went to any judicial
to say that in any judicial review of a denial of a rule waiver under this section, so basically the same language that relates to judicial review of a denial of a rule waiver is still there.
I'm trying to be very specific.
For purpose of has been deleted.
For purpose of, how about judicial review? Has that been deleted?
That has not. Then it begins with...
Where does it pick that up? That's what I'm looking for.
On line 10, it begins with any judicial.
So they reworded it as well.
Yeah, they took out for the purpose of and replaced it with in any.
I got it. Thank you very much. And that carries down to line 22, through line 22.
Yes, and what and all that was done after that, Representative Greenlee, Chair Kitts, is that he added sub A, sub B, and sub C after each sentence so that it's easier to follow.
Thank you.
Right. And it's simply a clarification so that we don't confuse the two different tests that are applicable.
Are there any other questions on the Dash 13s?
Well, there are lots of questions, but not how they relate to the 12.
The Dash 13s, obviously, if we consider, will replace the aforementioned section on the Dash 12. So I just want to make sure that the Dash 13s, there was no question on what they would do.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I've been pleased to work with the Speaker's Office and Representative Thatcher on, as your staff indicated to you, merging the contents of three bills on the similar topic of how the state goes about enacting administrative rules or regulations. I've met with each of you individually and provided you a more detailed briefing document about what was in the Dash 10 amendments, and indicated to you at that time that the Dash 12s would involve some minor fixes and adjustments. Broadly, what you have in front of you as the Dash 13s, which you've heard how those change from the Dash 12s, is a set of amendments we're fine with. I'd say that there are three broad themes to what's being done here. The first deals with advisory committees. Right now, agencies are strongly encouraged but not required to use advisory committees when they develop rules. That's appropriate because there are many, many rules agencies do that are, in fact, quite technical and which an advisory committee wouldn't be appropriate or a good use of anyone's time. However, what we're trying to do is improve the incentives that agencies have to use them and change a little bit the nature of the work. Two things that we do with advisory committees in this bill is we ask them to provide advice to the agency on what a fiscal impact statement for a rule should say. So that when you gather stakeholders who are going to have to comply with a rule together, that's the right group of people to ask, so how is this going to affect the public in terms of fiscal impact? The second thing we do is existing statute today requires agencies, if there's a significant adverse impact on small business, to identify ways that they can reduce that impact. And this bill will ask that advisory committee to offer an opinion to the agency. Is the proposed rule a significant adverse impact or not? And if it is, how could the agency comply comply with the rule. What we then do is we continue to allow agencies to simply make a determination whether or not they're going to use an advisory committee, but if they choose not to, any 10 people or anyone representing a membership of 10 or more people can object to the fiscal statement prior to rulemaking and essentially require the agency to go back and do that step again. So it continues to be fine for an agency to say this is non-controversial, it's technical, it's not worth an advisory committee, but they have a little bit of jeopardy to do rework if in fact they're wrong and a number of people show up to object. The second broad theme, and it was touched on a little bit with advisory committees, is small business impact. The bill before you tries in a number of ways to help agencies do a better job of assessing the impact of rules on small business. And to adjust for those impacts, the primary change beyond advisory committees is adding some minimum content regarding small business impacts to the required fiscal impact statement. Right now, agencies have to estimate what's going to be the cost on the public generally as well as on government to do a particular rule. This adds some minimum content based on existing information they have available, how many businesses would have to comply, what kinds of things would they have to do to comply, and some basic framework around which they can hang a fiscal impact statement. The third third major theme here is the notion of waiver. And the way that I've kind of colloquially tried to describe this to people is that I serve on a planning commission, and we were looking at rules for how high a retaining wall can be and how high a fence can be, and we started having people building on slopes where someone would put a fence on top of a retaining wall, and you started ending up having really big blank faces in people's backyards, and we thought, well, we should clarify our rules to deal with that. Then we started realizing that some places the slopes run different directions than the property lines do, and you'd get some funny results. So we started making sure the rule was really particular. And before long, we realized two things were happening. One was the rule was getting really, really complicated. And secondly, we knew there were going to be circumstances we couldn't anticipate. And so even with a really complex rule, you'd have situations where literally applying the rule came up with a result that didn't make any sense. And so what we did in that case is we said, here's the basic rule, but we'll also give the planning director the authority, if faced with circumstances that are different than envisioned here, to approve an alternative or to waive the rule if it achieves the same objective that the rule does. And that's really what the waiver concept in 3238 is intended to do, is to give agencies broad discretionary authority to consider waiving rules. They first have to make a decision about, are they going to consider waivers at all or not? If they are, and that's completely at their discretion. If they are going to consider waivers, then they have to adopt, if you will, a waiver rule. What are the criteria? What are the circumstances? What programs would it apply to? And that sort of thing. And then they would consider waivers under that waiver rule. The standard for judicial review that's in the bill is basically quite high. It's one of did they follow the criteria that they set out? And as long as there's not the phrase that's used is a manifest injustice. So in other words, a manifest injustice would be someone coming in with a set of circumstances and getting a waiver, somebody else coming in with substantially the same circumstances and not getting a waiver, that person would be entitled to the court going through the facts and circumstances and looking at the decision. Other than that, it's a process kind of a check. There are a great many changes in the bill, but rather than try to run through all 10 or 12 of them outside those three broad themes, it might be more useful if I simply entertain questions that you have.
Any questions for Mr. Allen?
Thank you. Is absurd, in this term absurd or undesirable results, is that a term of art in law? I mean, is it clear what an absurd result would be?
Chair and Representative Greenlick, I would say that I do not believe that absurd is a defined term. It is sort of an unusual turn of a phrase in this particular bill, so it would be a term of interpretation.
Would there be interest in defining what absurd means for the purposes of this? I mean, I know things that I consider absurd, other people consider quite normal. I always assume it's a problem I have, but
I thought it was vice versa.
Or maybe.
I mean, I, I, I'm just sort of struggling here a little bit because it's a matter of sort of, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, let's define it. It's another to actually figure out how you would define it outside the circumstances that apply to individual programs. I think it would be more easily defined in the waiver rule that an agency would establish if it chose to consider waivers, identify what are the kinds of outcomes that it would consider eligible for waiver.
Yes. How about undesirable? Undesirable for who? I mean, if somebody's going to ask for a waiver and they don't get it, that's an obviously undesirable result.
Well, Chair Thatcher, Representative Greenlick, I think clearly in that case the issue is desirable. The fundamental language that goes back, if you look at on the dash, 13 amendments on... at the bottom of page 3, subsection B, the fundamental thing you have to keep in mind is that the waiver has to be consistent with the objectives of the rule being waived and the statutes implemented. So there's sort of a baseline framework of you're trying to achieve an outcome, and you have to be consistent with achieving that outcome. Undesirable, I think, would have to then be read in the context of that kind of a baseline.
We don't trust agencies to promulgate rules, but we trust them to... interpret or observe or undesirable.
Can we ask a follow-up
question? Is it usual that we're going to give agencies the right to waive rules, and if they do not waive a rule, that leads to a judicial review? Is that usual? Or is it absurd and undesirable?
Yeah, Chair Thatcher, Representative Greenlick, you've actually hit on a technical issue that we were going to correct on the Senate side. That restriction of the review to denials was inadvertent, and elsewhere you could read it to apply to denials and approvals. So we were actually going to fix that review section to being a review standard for denials and approvals, if that was what you were aiming at.
If I may follow.
Follow up.
What I was aiming at is... in the current process, what merits a judicial review of a behavior by an agency? Is this expanding litigation, or is it common now for an agency to be judicially reviewed?
Sure, Representative Thatcher, Chair Thatcher, Representative Greenlick, and I'll presume that if I get somewhere in over my head that Christine Shute from the Attorney General's Office will jump up and muzzle me. But I would say that judicial review of agency actions is something that certainly happens now. It would happen in a context, for instance, of an agency finding someone in violation of rules and moving to enforcement, and then you would get into judicial review of not only the agency's enforcement action, but potentially the appropriateness of the rule that was established in the first place, the process the agency went through to do so, and so on. I don't think this adds a new tool for many agencies. I should say there are waiver provisions that exist in certain isolated statutes now. This adds a new authority, and it adds a new kind of review to go with it. I don't think it in and of itself represents some huge new area of litigation that's not currently happening in terms of litigating rules. And apparently I went in over my head.
She did jump up, yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Greenlick, Christine Shute from the Oregon Department of Justice. I think actually Pat did a pretty good job. We joke in administrative law that agencies can't even change the color of the toilet paper without issuing an order that's somehow subject to judicial review. But that's and that's barely a joke. So pretty much everything agencies do one way or another, including their refusal to do anything, is subject to judicial review one way or another. This highlights something, and by flagging it, perhaps we will have more opportunities for judicial review, but I don't think this really expands it.
That was the question, is whether it's expanded. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holby.
Thank you. Stepping back to the review that the legislator, a member of the legislature, and at least 25 persons request, to review a rule for compliance with the legislation. Currently, are rules reviewed for compliance with the statutes?
Thank you, Chair Thatcher. Representative Holvey, yes, currently there is already a legislative review process in statute. That process is triggered at the time that agencies make notice of intent to enact or amend a rule. They provide those to legislative council, those notices to legislative council. Also, if a rule is to implement a statute within, I think, 2 years of passage, it also goes to the chairs or co-chairs of the committees that took action on the bill during session. This section, and I apologize, I neglected to cover this in the broad overview, this section really does two things. Right now, any one person affected by a rule or any one legislator can ask for a legislative committee to review that rule and offer its opinion of whether that rule complies with statutory intent to the agency. And it's offering an opinion. It doesn't in any way stop a rule from being implemented or cause it to lose its effect at some point. The bill raises the threshold to get the review from one affected person or one legislator to one legislator and 25 people. But it also broadens what can be asked for review from new proposals to any existing rule. All that said, I guess it's worth noting that legislative committees are generally pretty free to set their agendas, and so I think committees already have a great deal of latitude if they want to look at a rule area or a particular rule proposal to do that review and offer that opinion. But this does have the effect of raising the bar but broadening the topic area.
According to this language, though, that it basically says that an interim or session committee shall review upon request. Is that currently how it is? Is that every request gets reviewed?
Yes, Chair Thatcher, Representative Holvey. Right now, the same standard applies of a committee shall review. And to my understanding, that's a current tool that's not used very often, even with that one affected person or one legislator threshold.
Thank you.
Representative March.
Thank you. In the judicial review section of this, where we do have the question that you're referring to, that we need to add the or approval. Because I certainly see instances in my neighborhood where, say, the OLCC has approved a license in some one place or another, and the neighbors aren't too happy about it. And so, you know, they may have waived a rule to get it in there, and the neighbors aren't too happy about that. So, are we?
Yes, Chair Kitz, Representative March. Had we known in time about the Bar Association's issue that caused the Dash 13s, we would have gotten that issue in the Dash 13s as well. It's something that we would intend to take care of on the Senate side. But that's our intent, would be that review applies to decisions either way on reviews. And we even think it's implied with language later in the bill. But like a lot of things with this bill, we want to be completely clear.
Representative Greenlee, did you have an additional question?
I have LC here now that might address that question you had earlier.
We're getting absurd.
Representative Greenlee, yeah. Do you need LC for a question to be answered?
Absurdity, I think, was the.
Oh, I'm very happy LC is coming to help enlighten me on
absurdity.
In terms of art. We have several lawyers out there. I think we could probably get a 3-2 vote or something.
It's absurd.
It's not absurd, but it's undesirable.
And Chair Kitz, members of the committee, if you had a question about absurd, is that the specific question?
My question was whether there was...
Hang on one second, Representative.
Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee, acting legislator.
Acting badly today across several committees. My question was whether the term absurd, and maybe undesirable as well, but the term absurd particularly was a term of art and law that we would know what it meant, or whether if we were going to use the term absurd, whether we ought to be defining it in this context.
Sheriff Kitz, Representative Greenlee, it is not a legal term of art. But what the courts normally do when they have a word like that, they will turn to actually a very specific dictionary definition. They will go to, I think it's the New Collegiate, certain volume that they always use, as, and we use one as well for purposes of the terminology, and they will look at the dictionary meaning to determine the legislative intent. Absurd means, well, you know what it means in the common meaning, and that is the use that they would use, and I presume that's the use that the agency would use as well.
Sort of like pornography. I know something is absurd when I see it, but my point is that other people don't necessarily know that.
Representative Greenlick, there frequently can be disagreement with respect to what is reasonable, what is, many of the terms that are used in the law are subject to question as to, you know, one person can see it one way and one person can see it another.
Are you suggesting amendments?
Well, I was suggesting if we're going to do amendments, we might want to define absurd, but, and we might take that dictionary, or we might find a term that is more precise, that has legal meaning to deal with it. I mean, I have a problem with both absurd and undesirable, because undesirable, this doesn't say undesirable to whom. Undesirable to the applicant, undesirable to the agency, undesirable to the state, undesirable to the state of the world.
From what is to what is absurd. The mystery shall go on, Dave. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, do you have any comment on undesirable?
Chair Kitt, Representative Greenlick. Again, most of these statutes involve some delegation to the agency. In almost all the a lot of the terminology that we use, where the agency is charged basically with making those sorts of decisions. Certainly the legislature is able, if they want to make a much more specific listing of what they intend by that, and thereby reducing the discretion of the agency.
Chair Kitt, Representative Greenlick, if I can add, I would say that I have not been overwhelmed with lots of requests from agencies eager to go wade into waiver waters if this bill passes. Rather, I would expect that this would end up being something of an experiment, and that a limited number of agencies would take some very careful steps into this issue, and that this is one where we'd work closely with them on how to go about dealing with that in the rules they would adopt to consider waivers.
Dave, if Representative Greenlick has some concerns with the use of the two words absurd and undesirable, I'm sure that together with those two smart people that you are, you could probably come up with a little bit different.
Did you call it an airstrike, Representative Kitt?
It's not an attack. It's
They're angry about BRAC. What I'm curious about is, Representative, if you could just work with, I'm sure there are several other words that we could put in place of those two words to make that palatable to you. So if you would like to go ahead and work on that, I can.
Thank you. I'll be happy to do that.
Okay.
And at that same time, if I'm going to propose an amendment, then we can
work with
the amendment that talks about dealing with both the allowing judicial review on either side of that, which I assume was.
I would suggest that if you have two separate amendments, that you also draft them in two separate amendments and not together.
Okay.
Just make sure they're all palatable to the committee. It's the same steps that I'm taking with regard to 1008. Are you finished?
Unless there are other questions, I'm through.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, I'm just sort of curious whether obviously the Office of Regulatory Streamlining sees this as an improvement to the current system that the legislature actually reviews rules.
Chair Kitt, Representative Holvey, probably more accurate to say is that this bill largely mirrors the recommendations of an advisory committee that you all established last session that we staffed, that looked extensively at these sets of issues. We then worked with Representative Thatcher and the Speaker's office on adding concepts from their bills that made this a fuller package. And I think all of the things you see in the bill are things that are concepts that don't cause concern about separation of powers or issues like that that I think came up in your previous hearing, and in many respects improve the advisory committee's recommendations.
I think that's a yes.
I didn't hear it.
Kind of like absurd. It's however you.
Are there any other questions of either Patrick or David at this time? Seeing none, thank you, guys. Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Chair Kitson and members. Just a quick statement of support from NFIB in favor of the amendments to House Bill 3238. Our concern has always been ensuring that agencies really knew what they were doing in terms of an impact on business when enacting rules, and that's really been our main concern all along. This measure addresses it quite nicely. Also, to address Representative Holvey's question in terms of legislative oversight, we've always been concerned about giving citizens, businesses a forum with some substance if they have a problem with agency rules, and I think it's perfectly appropriate that if a problem bubbles to the service that warrants that kind of attention, that you should take a look at it, because nothing gets their attention like a legislator saying to knock it off. And so we strongly favor that.
Thank you, JL. Are there any questions for JL? Seeing none, thank you, JL. Colleagues, is there any further discussion on House Bill 3238? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3238. Anything else for the good of the order?